And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Ellen Pritchard. Today, I'll be reading two stories from the book A Mountain of Gems, Fairy Tales of the Peoples of the Soviet Land. Pilipka, a Belarusian fairy tale. Once there lived a man and his wife. They had no children, and the wife was always sorrowing and grieving that she had no one to rock in the cradle and to kiss and fondle. One day, the husband went to the forest, chopped down an alder tree, and brought a log home to his wife. "Here," said he, "rock this." The wife put the log in a cradle, and she began rocking it, and saying as she rocked, "Little son, rock-a-bye, you were white of body and dark of eye." She rocked the log one day, and she rocked it the next, and on the third day she looked, and there, lying in the cradle, was a little baby boy. The husband and wife were overjoyed. They called their little son Pilipka and began caring for him tenderly. When Pilipka grew up, he said to his father, "Make me a golden boat, father, and a silver paddle. I want to go fishing." And the father made him a golden boat and a silver paddle and sent him to the lake to catch fish. Pilipka set to fishing in earnest, and he fished whole days and nights on end. Indeed, so well were the fish biting that he would not even go home, and his mother brought his dinner to him. She would come to the lake and call, "Pilipka, my son, the day is half done, and here is a pie for you to try." And Pilipka would make for the shore, throw the fish he had caught out onto it, and having eaten his mother's pie, paddle to the middle of the lake again. Now, Baba Yaga, the witch with a switch, hearing how his mother called to Pilipka, decided to kill him. She took a sack and a poker, came to the lake, and called, "Pilipka, my son, the day is half done, and here is a pie for you to try." Pilipka thought it was his mother calling, and paddled to the shore, and Baba Yaga caught his boat with her poker, dragged it up the bank, and seizing Pilipka, thrust him into her sack. "You won't be catching fish anymore, my lad," she cried. And throwing the sack over her shoulder, she carried it off with her into the forest. But the way to her house being long, she soon grew tired, sat down for a rest, and fell asleep. And Pilipka crawled out of the sack, filled it full of stones, and went back to the lake again. Some time passed, and Baba Yaga woke up, caught up the sack, and carried it home with many moans and groans. She brought it home, and she said to her daughter, "Roast this fisherman of mine for our dinner." She shook the sack and shook it again, but nothing but stones dropped out of it. Baba Yaga flew into a temper. "I'll show you how to fool me," she cried at the top of her voice. And running to the lake shore again, she began calling to Pilipka. "Pilipka, my son, the day is half done, and here is a pie for you to try." Pilipka heard her and called back, "I know you well. You're not my mother, but Baba Yaga. My mother's voice is ever so much thinner." And though Baba Yaga kept calling to him, Pilipka did not heed her. "Never you mind," said Baba Yaga to herself. "I'll make me a thin little voice." And she ran to a blacksmith. "Please, blacksmith, sharpen my tongue and make it thinner," said she. "Very well," replied the blacksmith. "Just put it on my anvil." So Baba Yaga stuck out her tongue and laid it on the anvil, and the blacksmith took his hammer and pounded away at it till it became quite thin. After that, Baba Yaga ran to the lake, and she called to Pilipka in a thin little voice, "Pilipka, my son, the day is half done, and here is a pie for you to try." Pilipka heard her, thought it was his mother calling. He paddled to the shore, and Baba Yaga snatched him up and thrust him into her sack. "You won't fool me anymore," Baba Yaga cried overjoyed, and took him straight home without stopping to rest. She shook him out of the sack and said to her daughter, "Here he is, the cheat. Light the stove and roast him." And with these words he ran out again. And her daughter lit the stove, and taking a spade, said to Philippa, "Lie down on the spade so I can put you in the stove." And Philippa lay down on the spade in such a way that his legs stuck up in the air. "Not like that," said Baba Yaga's daughter. "I won't be able to put you in the stove if you hold your legs up." Philippa dropped his legs, letting them hang down over the spade. "Oh, not like that," Baba Yaga's daughter cried again. "Then how?" Philippa asked. "Show me." "Oh, how stupid you are," exclaimed Baba Yaga's daughter. "This is the way to do it. Look." She stretched herself out on the spade, and Philippa snatched up the spade and shoved it into the burning stove, and after that he closed the stove and put Baba Yaga's poker against it so that her daughter could not jump out. He ran out of the hut. Here was Baba Yaga coming towards it. What was Philippa to do? There was a tall and leafy sycamore tree growing near the hut, so he climbed it quickly and hid himself amid the branches. Baba Yaga came into the hut. She sniffed, and she smelt the smell of roasting meat. She took the roast out of the stove, ate up the meat, and throwing the bones out into the yard, began rolling over them, saying as she did so, "On these bones I did fall, or these bones I will roll, for I have eaten of Philippa's flesh, and I have drunk of his blood." And Philippa called to her from his hiding place, "On these bones you may fall, or these bones you may roll, for you have eaten of your daughter's flesh and drunk of your daughter's blood." Baba Yaga heard him, and she turned dark with rage. She ran to the sycamore tree and began chewing at it. She chewed, and she chewed, and she broke her teeth. But the tree stood there and was as tough and strong as ever. Baba Yaga ran to the blacksmith. "Oh, please, blacksmith," cried she, "forge me a steel axe. If you don't, I'll eat up your children." The blacksmith was frightened and forged her an axe. And Baba Yaga rushed with it to the sycamore tree and began chopping it down. Said Philippa, "Strike no tree, but strike a rock." Said Baba Yaga, "Strike no rock, but strike the tree." Said Philippa again, "Strike no tree, but strike a rock." And the axe suddenly struck a rock and was chipped and blunted. Baba Yaga gave a howl of rage, snatched up the axe and went back to the blacksmith's with it to have it sharpened. Philippa looked and saw that the sycamore tree was beginning to lean over to one side. Baba Yaga had chopped it nearly through, and he had to hurry to save himself before it was too late. But just then a flock of geese came flying over the tree. "Oh, come, geese, do please each of you give me a feather," he called to them. "To my mother and father I will fly with you, and there I will pay you for your service true." Each of the geese gave him a feather, and of these feathers Philippa fastened himself half a wing. Then a second flock of geese came flying, and Philippa saw them and called, "Come, geese, do please each of you throw me a feather. To my mother and father I will fly with you, and there I will pay you for your service too." And of these geese too, each gave him a feather. Then a third flock of the geese came flying up, and a fourth. And Philippa was very showered with feathers. He fastened himself a pair of wings and flew after the geese. Just then Baba Yaga came running for the blacksmith's shop, and she began chopping down the sycamore tree again, making the chips fly to all sides of it. She chopped and she chopped, and the sycamore tree fell down on her with a great crash and killed her. As for Philippa, he came flying home with the geese. When his mother and father saw him, they were overjoyed. They seated him at the table and gave him many nice things to eat. And to the geese they gave oats and ale. And that is the end of this long, short tale. The Three Brothers in the Pot of Gold, a Moldavian fairy tale. Once upon a time there lived a man who had three sons. He was a hard-working man and labored from morn till night. But his sons did not take after their father. They were strong and healthy lads, all three, but terrible loafers who did not want to do anything at all. The father worked in the field, in the garden, and in the house, but his sons sat chatting in the shade under the trees or went to the Meester for days fishing. "Why do you never help your father?" their neighbors asked. "Why should we?" the sons replied. "Father takes good care of us and does all the work very well by himself." And so it went from year to year. The sons grew to manhood, and the father aged and could no longer work as before. The garden round the house ran wild, and the field was overgrown with weeds. The sons saw this, but were so lazy they'd do nothing about it. "Why do you sit there, my sons, idling the hours away?" their father would ask of them. "I worked hard all my life, and now your time has come to do the same." But no matter what he said, his sons would not listen to him and did nothing but twiddle their thumbs. So troubled was the old man that his sons were such loafers that he fell ill and took to his bed. By now the family were in the direst need. Nettles and thistles grew so thick around the house it was barely visible. One day the old man called his sons to his bedside. "My end has come, my son," said he. "How are you going to live without me, loafers that you are?" Oh, the sons burst into tears. "Oh, give us your last counsel, father," the eldest son begged. "Tell us what we are to do." "Very well," the father replied. "I'll tell you a secret. You know that your mother and I toiled hard and ceaselessly. Over the years, bit by bit, we were able to put aside what we earned till we had a whole pot full of gold. I buried the pot near the house. Only I don't remember just where. Find it, and you will be rich and never know need." With that, he bade his sons goodbye and breathed his last. But his sons were deeply grieved, and they wept and sorrowed for a long time. One day the eldest of them said, "Well, brothers, we are poor indeed. We haven't even money enough to buy bread with. Let us do as our father bade before he died and look for the pot of gold." They took their spades and began digging near the house. They dug and they dug, but they did not find the pot of gold. Said the middle brother, "If we dig like this, my brothers, we will never find the pot. Let us dig up the ground all around the house." And the brothers agreed. They took up their spades again and they dug up the ground all around the house, but no pot of gold did they find. "Let's dig some more, but deeper," said the youngest brother. "Perhaps father buried the pot of gold deep down." Well, once again, the brothers agreed. They were very eager to find the pot. They set to work, and the eldest brother, who had been digging a long time, suddenly felt his spade strike something quite big and hard. His heart pounded wildly, for he thought he found the pot of gold. He called to his brothers to come to him quickly. The two brothers came running and began helping their elder brother dig. They worked very, very hard, but what they dug up from the ground was not a pot of gold, but a large stone. The brothers were disappointed. "Well, what shall we do with the stone?" said they. "It's no use leaving it here. Let's carry it away and throw it in a gully." No sooner said than done. They got rid of the stone and began digging again. They worked all day long, never stopping to eat or rest, and they dug up the whole of the garden. The soil under their spades became nice and soft, but for all their efforts, no pot of gold did they find. "Now that we've dug up the garden, it's no use leaving things at that. Let us plant grapevines here," said the eldest brother. "Oh, that's a good idea," the two younger brothers agreed. "At least our labors will not have been wasted." So they planted some grapevines and began tending them carefully. A short time passed, and they had a fine, large vineyard where ripened fine, juicy grapes. The brothers gathered a rich harvest. They put aside the grapes they needed for themselves and sold the rest at a profit. And said the eldest brother, "It was not in vain, after all, that we dug up our garden, for we found the treasure of which father spoke before he died." You've been listening to stories from the book A Mountain of Gems, Fairy Tales of the Peoples of the Soviet Land, published in Moscow by Rabiga. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tanella, and I'm Ellen Whitcher.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hi, I'm Marion Flowers. Today I'll be reading from the book Martin Luther King Jr., written by Beth P. Wilson. It was a warm day in Atlanta, Georgia, in the spring of 1968. The streets were full of people just returning from a funeral. Their hearts were heavy because a great man was dead. This black man was a great leader. He wanted freedom and equal rights for everybody. He had tried especially hard to help the poor black people. The people all over the world loved this man. His coffin had been placed on an old farm wagon pulled by two mules. Behind it walked almost 100,000 people. They were rich and poor, black and white. The great man's name was Martin Luther King Jr. He was born in Atlanta in 1929. As a boy, Martin liked to read. He was so smart in school that he skipped two grades. Every day after school, he delivered newspapers. Martin was always friendly with everyone he met. But some white people were not so friendly to him. This troubled Martin.
Don't white people like black people? He asked his parents. Why don't black children and white children go to the same schools and churches? Why do black people have to sit in the back of the bus?
His parents tried to tell him about the white people's laws. They were unfair laws because they did not let the black people have the same rights as the white people. His parents said that black people would have to work to change the laws. Then all people would be treated fairly. Martin's mother told him to always remember that he was as good and as smart as anybody. Martin wanted to help change the laws. He began to think about what he would do when he grew up. He could become a doctor and help sick people, or he might become a lawyer and defend people in court. Perhaps he could be a fine minister like his father and his grandfather and help people in a church. Martin decided to be a minister like his father. A minister could help the sick and hungry, and he could help people to be kind to one another. After studying at several schools, Martin became the minister of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. He always preached a good sermon, and the church people liked him because he was a kind and gentle man. In December 1955, there was trouble in Montgomery. Mrs. Rosa Parks, a black woman, was riding a bus home from work. The bus driver told Mrs. Parks to stand up so a white person could sit down. Mrs. Parks was very tired. She would not stand up. When the policeman arrested Mrs. Parks, black people became very angry. Dr. King talked to the people. He asked them to stop riding the buses. He said they could ride together in cars or they could walk to work. If the white people who ran the buses would not treat black people fairly, then the black people would not pay the money to ride on the buses. Dr. King told the black people they should not fight. It was better, he said, to try to change the laws in a nonviolent way. Hundreds of people listened to the speeches Dr. King and other black leaders made. The news began to spread. Thousands of black people got tired, sore feet from walking, but they did not ride the Montgomery buses for a whole year. The bus company lost money. At last, the Supreme Court said the unfair laws had to be changed. Now black people could sit wherever they wanted on the buses. They did not have to give their seats to white people. People all over the world heard about what had happened in Montgomery and about a new, young black leader, Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. King became president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He said the people must try to change more unfair laws, but in a nonviolent way, without fighting. And Dr. King went from city to city to give help. He led marches and sit-ins. Sometimes the people stopped to pray. Some white people worked with the black people because they wanted to have fair laws, too. Young college men and women marched and helped. But many white people became angry. They did not want black people to have the same rights as they had. They did not want the laws changed. Some of the marchers were beaten and put into jail. Many marchers lost their jobs and their houses and churches were bombed. But the black people were beginning to be less afraid. Dr. King was called names and beaten. He was put into jail 17 times. But he always thought about his father and how he preached about all people loving one another. And he thought about the great leader of India, Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi had shown his people how to gain freedom without fighting. He said there were other ways to protest. People could lie down in the streets and stop traffic, or they could protest by not eating until some changes were made. It was not easy for Dr. King to be away from his wife and his family, but sometimes Dr. King had to be alone to think and pray and write. People also called for Dr. King to come to see them day and night. Many times he felt too tired to go, but he always went. Afterward, he would tell his wife that he felt better. He felt better because he loved people and was helping them to help themselves. Many black people and some white people were injured or killed when they made protests. Sometimes, when the marchers were very tired, they would join hands and sing songs with words like, "We shall overcome. We shall overcome. Black and white together. We shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome someday." In the summer of 1963, thousands upon thousands of black and white people went to Washington, D.C. They walked behind Dr. King and other leaders, black and white. Dr. King gave a speech called, "I Have a Dream." It was the dream about fair laws for everyone. Everyone must have the freedom to work and to vote. Everyone must have the freedom to send their children to good schools. Everyone must have the freedom to live where he wants to live. Blacks and whites must join hands in friendship and live in peace together. Dr. King said it was wrong for people to fight and kill one another. He said wars were wrong anywhere in the world. People everywhere should learn to love and not hate. In October of the next year, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. won the Nobel Peace Prize. That same year, other unfair laws were changed. Black and white people could go to the same parks and other places, and black people would have the same working rights. But in the South and some other parts of the country, the white leaders were still not obeying the new laws. Still, many black and white people began to fight one another over schools, houses, and jobs. Black people said they were tired of not being treated fairly. They had a right, they said, to the same things the white people had. The black people had helped to build America. It was their country, too. Soon, some of the new black leaders said Dr. King's nonviolent way would not work. They talked about black power and fighting in a violent way to get their rights. Some of Dr. King's helpers thought these new leaders might be right. The new laws were not being enforced. But Dr. King did not agree. He still prayed that people would learn to love and help one another without fighting. He said it was the only way they could ever be happy together. He made many more speeches for the poor people of all races. They were hungry and cold and sick. They needed jobs and good houses and schools. A great march on the Capitol in Washington, D.C. was planned. All the poor people from all over the country were to come and stay until Congress made better laws to help them. Everyone everywhere must see how so many poor people suffered in the richest country in the world. But before the poor people's march could take place, there was trouble in Memphis, Tennessee. The black people there called for Dr. King to come and help the black garbage workers to get fair working conditions. He went and led a march for the people. Before he could leave Memphis, a white man who had been in jail many times shot and killed him. People all over the world were shocked and sad. They sent cards and letters to Dr. King's family. They sent money to carry on his work. And they named buildings, schools, and other places in memory of Dr. King. The loss of a great leader made people everywhere know that they must try harder to be fair with one another. They must try to love and not hate. They must learn to live together in peace. And they thanked Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. for trying to show them the way.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
You've been listening to a story adapted from the book Martin Luther King Jr. by Beth P. Wilson, published by G.P. Putnam Sons. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tamella. And I'm Marion Clay.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Ellen Whitcher. Today, I'll be reading from the book A Mountain of Gems fairy tales of the peoples of the Soviet land. To each his dessert, an Estonian fairy tale. Once upon a time, a poor old man was walking along the road. Dusk had descended and night was approaching. The old man decided to ask for shelter, and he knocked at the window of a large house. "Let me in for the night, good folk," said he. Hearing him, the mistress of the house, a rich and haughty woman, came out and began to scold the stranger and shout at him. "I'll let the dogs loose on you," she cried. "Then you'll know how to ask people to put you up for the night. Get away from here." The old man walked on. He saw a poor little house and he knocked at the window. "Won't you give me shelter for the night, good folk?" he asked. "Oh, come in, come in," the mistress of the house called to him in friendly tones. "You're welcome to spend the night with us, only it's noisy and there isn't much room. I hope you don't mind." The stranger came into the house, and he saw that the family was very poor. There were many children, and the shirts they had on were tattered and worn. "Well, why do you let your children go about in such rags?" the stranger asked. "Why don't you make them new shirts?" "Oh, how can I?" the woman replied. "My husband is dead, and I have to bring up the children all by myself. We haven't enough money for bread even, let alone clothing." The stranger heard her out and said not a word in reply, and the mistress of the house put the food on the table and invited him to join them. "Come and eat with us," said she. "Oh, no, thank you," the old man replied. "I'm not hungry. I ate but a short time ago." And untying his bag, he took out all the food there was in it and gave it to the children. After that, he lay down on the floor in a corner of the room and at once fell asleep. In the morning, the old man rose, thanked the mistress of the house for her hospitality, and said, in parting, "That which you do in the morning, you will do till evening." The woman did not understand the stranger's words and paid them no heed. She saw him to the gate and came back into the house. "Well, if even this poor man says that my children look like ragamuffins, what will other people say?" she thought to herself. And as there was not enough cloth for more, she decided to make one shirt out of the last piece of cloth she had in the house. So she went to her rich neighbor's house to borrow a yardstick to measure the cloth and see if there was enough for even that one shirt. The rich neighbor gave it to her, and she hurried to a storeroom with it. She took the piece of cloth from the shelf and began to measure it. As she did so, the piece kept growing larger and larger, and there seemed no end to it. She spent the whole day measuring it, and only finished late in the evening. She was sure now that she had enough cloth to last her and her children all their lives. "So that was what the stranger meant," she said to herself. That same evening, she took the yardstick back to her rich neighbor, and without holding anything back, told her how, at the word of the old man, a stranger, she had acquired a storeroom of cloth. "Dear me, why didn't I let him in for the night?" the rich woman said to herself, and she called to her workmen, "Come, my man, harness a horse quickly, and ride fast after that beggar. Bring him back here at any cost. The poor should be helped without stint. I always said so." The workman at once drove off in search of the old man, and he caught him up on the following day. But the old man refused to go back. The workman was sorely grieved. "Oh, unhappy man that I am," said he. "If I don't bring you back, my mistress will drive me out of the house and leave me without wages." "Oh, don't fret, my lad," the old man said. "So be it. I'll go with you." And climbing into the cart, he drove off with the workman. Oh, the rich woman stood at her gate, all impatient. She met the old man with bows and smiles, and leading him into the house, gave him food and drink, and made up a soft bed for him, saying, "Lie down, father, and rest." The old man lived in the rich woman's house for a day, and for another, and for a third. He ate and drank and slept and smoked his pipe. The mistress of the house gave him food and drink, and she spoke kindly to him, but inwardly she was fuming. "Well, the old good-for-nothing, get out of here," said she to herself. But she dared not turn the old man out, for then all the trouble she had gone through on his account. old man began getting ready to leave. The rich woman went to see him off. As he walked silently to the gate and out of it, she could restrain herself no longer. What am I to do today, tell me, she asked. The old man looked at her. That which you do in the morning, you will do till evening, said he. Oh, the rich woman rushed into the house, and she snatched up a yardstick in order to measure her cloth. But she sneezed suddenly, and so loudly, that the chickens in the yard were frightened and fluttered off in all directions. And she kept on sneezing all day without a stop. She could neither eat nor drink nor answer any questions. All that came from her was, achoo! And only when the sun had set and darkness fell did she stop sneezing. How a lord turned into a horse, a Latvian fairy tale. In olden times there lived a cruel lord who never spared his workmen and forced them to work until they were half dead. He gave them no rest even on holidays. One morning on a big holiday when most people were resting from their labors, the lord sent his workmen to the barn to thresh grain. Now the workmen had been threshing all the past day and all night and were so tired they could hardly stand. They had just set to work when the lord himself rushed into the barn armed with a stick. It seemed to him that his workmen were too slow, and he fell on them with threats, flourishing his stick angrily. You loafers, he shouted, you won't leave the barn till you've threshed all the rye. The men made no reply to this, but they asked the lord to let them hitch a horse to the threshers, that the work might be done more quickly. Oh, so now it's a horse you want, do you? The lord cried. Well, I'll strangle every one of you loafers with my own hands if you so much as dare suggest such a thing again. You'll get no horse from me. The horse must rest. You can very well do the work yourselves. And having shouted himself hoarse, the lord hurried from the threshing barn, for there's little pleasure in swallowing dust. But no sooner left than the workman heard someone call out, whoa there, whoa! Then a horse neighed and a bridle jangled. It was clear that a horse was being harnessed. Who could be doing it? Suddenly, an old man entered the threshing barn. He was very, very old, with a long gray beard and eyes that flashed like lightning. Behind him, led firmly by the reins, came a sturdy bay stallion. The old man greeted the workman. Here's a horse for you, said he. Hitch him to the thresher and use him for the hardest work. When you go to the forest, don't load timber in a cart, but after felling a tree, tie the horse to its crown and let him drag the tree, boughs and all, to the lord's house. If he balks and refuses to do it, lash his flanks and back mercilessly. Lash all of him save his head, and don't spare the whip, and don't give him anything to eat. When you've led him into the stall in the evening, hoist him on straps up to the ceiling. Let him hang there for a night after a day's work. It will only do him good. And with these words, the old man vanished. The horse neighed loudly, and so closely did the tones of his voice resemble those of the lord that the workman knew that he was not a horse at all, but the lord in a horse's shape. Oh, it must have been old Father Percone himself, Lord of Thunder and Lightning, that brought him here, said they. And Percone's command must be obeyed. What he has told us to do with the horse, that we will do. They hitched the stallion to the thresher and at once set to work. Now the stallion was stubborn, and he jibbed and neighed and stamped his hoofs and twisted his neck and made it plain that he did not want to work. But they paid no heed to this and gave him a lashing instead. And so it went from that day on. Whenever the hardest work had to be done, they were sure to use the bay stallion for it. And if he balked, they flogged him mercilessly. The stallion would toil all day without resting, and when night came, he would be taken to a stall and hoisted on straps up to the ceiling to hang there till morning. Nor was he given any food. In all the time he worked, he only succeeded in stealing a wisp of straw now and then in winter and nibbling at some nettles that grew near the fence in summer, and that was all. Now, on the third day that the stallion had made his appearance, the cruel lord had disappeared. His lady searched and searched for him, but she could not find him. A whole year went by. In the beginning, the stallion had been strong and stately and sleek, but by the end of the year, he wasted away. His mouth hung loose, his ribs poked through his flanks, his back had caved in, and his mane was limp and straggly. One day, the lady saw the stallion in the yard, and she said to the steward, "Oh, that wretched old horse there had better be taken to the forest and shot. It makes me sick to look at him." But the steward too must have guessed that the horse was really the lord in his shape and did not kill him. One morning, on a big holiday when everyone was resting, the stallion quietly left his stall. He got into the lord's kitchen garden and began eating the cabbages. The lady went out for a walk. She strolled into the kitchen garden, and what did she see but the stallion greedily peeling off cabbage leaves and swallowing them. Oh, the lady flew into a passion. "Oh, you good-for-nothing brute!" "No," cried she, "just wait, I'll teach you a lesson." And picking up a thick stick, she caught the horse a blow over the head. And lo and behold, there before her stood her lord himself. Said the lord in a weak voice, "Oh, my dear wife, why do you beat me? Do you grudge me a few cabbage leaves? After a year of starvation, they seem sweeter to me than the choicest dishes I ever tasted." Well, now the lady recognized him, and she gasped in horror. The lord did not look like himself at all. He was very thin and dark of face, and his beard and his fingernails had grown very long. His whole body was a mass of cuts and bruises, and of his clothes nothing was left but tatters. The lady seized him by the hand and led him quietly into the house so that no one might see him. And from that time on, the lord was always meek and humble. You've been listening to stories from A Mountain of Gems, Fairy Tales of the Peoples of the Soviet Land, published by Raduga Press. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tanella. And I'm Ellen Fisher.